Now we're beginning. This is class number 6. So glad you guys are here. Let's take a look at this. If you remember from our very first time together way back, does 6 weeks ago just seem like forever and a day? It does to me. I know it goes quickly, but at the same time, it's like, wow, 6 weeks has gone by. Man. So one thing I want you to remember about what we're learning about personal growth is we're trying to make a shift. And in this shift, what we want to do to grow inside our hula hoop is as we are in our hula hoop, we're going to be around people that matter to us, people we care about, people who are significant to us. They're significant in kind of one way or the other. We matter to them, they matter to us, whatever that mattering is. What we want to understand is we want to make a shift that the closer that we get to a person and the more they matter, we want to increase our own self-awareness inside our hula hoop, because there's a lot going on in this hula hoop that we can learn about. It's fascinating when you really think about it. What we are prone to do is increase our awareness about the other person. Whoever's mattering to us, we begin to increase our awareness about them. That's natural. But you need to make a shift. The more that somebody matters in your life, the more significant they are, let's increase our own awareness and try to understand what's going on inside our own hula hoop. Why? So we can effectively relate to somebody else. So we're going to increase our own self-awareness. Can you think of any scriptures that talk about increasing our own awareness with God, but the awareness of ourself with God? You think any? How about any of the Psalms? Psalm 139, David prays, "Search me, O God. Know my heart." Psalm 139, verse 23 and 24. "Try me and know my anxious thoughts." So what do you think the word "try me" means? What's the idea? Try me. Test. Yeah. Put me under a test. Now think about that. Remember I said when we started, we are all relatively mature inside our own hula hoop when we're all by ourselves in a 100-acre field. Make sense? I may seem healthy until I'm put under an examination medically. So if you put me on a treadmill, a stress test, you incline the treadmill, you speed it up, and you hook me up with all kinds of instruments, what might we find out? That's right. We're going to get some vital data when you put my body under a stress test. When it's not under a stress test, you can't see what needs to be addressed. Make sense? So on the spiritual journey, the psalmist prays, "Try me, put me under a stress test, cross-examine me, put me under pressure," because it's only under pressure that our character or our weak places and strong places will be revealed. Make sense? So we're all relatively mature when not much is at stake. When you put us in the presence of somebody who's mattering more and more, we may see some weak places in our life. So David, the psalmist, says, "Search me, O God, know my heart. Try me, test me, put me under a cross examination, know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any way of pain in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. So it's a willing examination before God to see any places of immaturity. So instead of becoming more aware of others, let's try to become more aware of ourselves. Why did I say that in the presence of this person? Why did I act so nervous and feel inferior in the presence of this person? Why did I feel comfortable in the presence of this person? Wonder what factors were going on. So we want to increase self-awareness. We want to increase personally confronting ourselves. Now, it's funny that somehow we as Christians will immediately think of confront everybody else in love. Right? The passage in Ephesians. I don't think we really think through and talk about, well, let's confront ourselves first before we talk to anybody. Does that make sense? When we feel offended, we just want to go to somebody else and somehow talk to them about how they offended us. What we may be blind to is we may have been contributing to the interaction in ways that we can't see. And then we got a response from them, but we did not see our own contribution. We only see their response. So then we want to talk to them. And I would say if we make a shift, let's learn to ask ourselves a lot of questions before we confront anybody else. So we're making this shift. We're accepting 100% personal responsibility. We're not blaming others. And we're going to see a little bit more. We're not blaming them for our emotions and for our feelings. We have emotions. They're ours. They're going to tell you something about you. Maybe something about the situation. But as we saw, it could be completely inaccurate what they tell you you think about others or about the world. Your brain may be wrong, but your emotions are real. What's creating the emotions may be a misinterpretation and a misunderstanding. So let's accept personal responsibility and let's humbly manage ourselves inside our own hula hoop. Humbly, with humility. We just don't know a lot. Say things like, I could be incorrect. I could be wrong. It seems this way to me. It appears this way to me. I'm not so sure. It seems, it appears, it could be. When you dialogue with anybody, keep an openness that says, I could be misperceiving and misunderstanding this. People feel more warmly invited toward us if we do that. Cultivate a self-soothing anchor. I've said you need a teddy bear. You need a blankie. You need something inside your hula hoop. It's personal faith, then anchor to your personal faith, anchor to forgiveness through Christ, a new identity in Christ, risen, as we will celebrate next Sunday, risen with the living Christ. And then find the value in doing any of this, which is, we're going to think through that just a little bit. Why undergo something difficult if there's no personal value for you in it? If we're going to do something challenging, I want to help people find the value. Why would you do this? I don't know. The pastor wants me to. My best friend wants me to. My spouse wants me to. Well, what do you want? And then their brain goes to mush. It's like a lot of shoulds and oughts. Okay? So we're shifting away from cooperation, reciprocity, protesting, fault finding, and even making the relationship a soothing anchor. So I like this shift, the personal growth shift, because we're moving from being a victim to being a victor. That's a great move. We're moving from helplessness to empowerment by making this shift. We're also moving away from being a reactor to everything in life to being a responder. Once we move the route for 100% acceptance of that which is in front of us, we're no longer protesting. Just accept it. Acceptance first of everything exactly the way it is. Don't protest. Don't protest the traffic on LBJ or Central Expressway. It's not going to do you any good. 100% acceptance of everything just as it is. Then we can create and craft a response to it rather than a reaction. It's freedom versus slavery. We're going to change anxiety into adventure, powerlessness into empowerment, and hopeless to hopeful by making these shifts. We're no longer tethered to everybody else for our security. We're tethered to God. We have relationships, but relationships and other people are not our soothing mechanisms anymore. Does that make sense? They're not your soothing mechanism. You can't love somebody if you need them to be your soothing mechanism. So we're making shifts for freedom's sake. So here's a quote. You might like this. People are often unreasonable, irrational, and self-centered. Forgive them anyway. If you are kind, people may accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Be kind anyway. If you're successful, you will win some unfaithful friends and some genuine enemies. Succeed anyway. If you're honest and sincere, people may deceive you. Be honest and sincere anyway. What you spend years creating, others could destroy overnight. Create anyway. If you find serenity and happiness, some may be jealous. Be happy anyway. The good you do today will often be forgotten. Do good anyway. Give the best you have and it may never be enough. Give your best anyway. In the final analysis, it's between you and God. It was never between you and them anyway. Do you like that?
I love it.
Now, can you see that those words of wisdom, that person has made a shift? What's the shift away from?
Others.
Yes. Well said, Debbie. Just succinctly. Look, this Mother Teresa, in making this quote, says nobody can rob you of the good things that you can do. Nobody can rob us of that. Unless we tether ourselves to them. And as Linda shared last week, one of you, I thought it was Linda, but it might have been somebody over here. Well, thank you, it was you. Remember Eleanor Roosevelt's quote.
Oh, yes.
That was your quote. Thank you. And remember Eleanor Roosevelt said, nobody can make you feel inferior without your cooperation or permission. So what we're doing in making this shift is a lot of people think, well, Billy, you're talking in very selfish terms by making this shift. Not at all. Remember, differentiation is growing up so that we may powerfully connect with the people we love and care about the most. To be close to them without losing the essence of who we are. To join with them in partnerships, love them, accept them, without requiring them to change for us. Isn't that interesting? Why require anybody to be who they are? That person has to find the value. We'll talk about that in a little bit. Okay, so where we left off, let's pick up with a couple of good ideas. Remember back to the story of Adam and Eve for a moment? You remember last week, where we left off? Remember Adam and Eve in the garden, and they had had a conversation with the enemy, the serpent. And the serpent put a lot of doubts in Eve's mind. Remember that? Now, life was rocking along until they had this powerful conversation, and lots of things were implied. So it caused a lot of self-doubt. Remember that? Did God say this? Did God say that? God's withholding from you. Now, she thought about this and thought about it, ruminated on it. Is that a good word? It's a good word, right? What does ruminate mean? Yes, go over it again and again. Well, here's a little word picture that I like. I like words and the field of meanings of words, very expressive language. Ruminate comes from the Latin word rumen, which is a cud-chewing animal. So it brings it up, chews on it, swallows it, brings it up, chews on it. So to ruminate, I like to say as human beings, it's kind of a crud-chewing animal. You're just chewing on your crud. Because when you ruminate, is it usually positive or negative? It's usually negative, going over and over and over. It's a crud-chewing human being, bringing it up, swallowing it, bringing it up, going over and over and over. So she's ruminating on this, pondering this, and then it all comes to fruition in her mind, and she says, oh, I see it clearly right now. I see it. I see something that I didn't see before. So when the woman saw, now remember, she had been seeing this fruit, she and Adam, all the time. So let's talk about this experience. It's like the text says, wait, now when she saw, after this conversation, something was planted in her brain, now when she looked at it, it appeared differently. Something stood out to her that it was good for food. It's very practical. It was delight to the eyes. What do you think that means? Keep going. Yes. There's something aesthetically pleasing now about this beautiful thing. It's a delight to the eyes. It's aesthetically pleasing. And it was desirable to make one wise, so there was something enhancing for her personhood, for their personhood. So when all of this came together, in the mind first, the heart, the mind, whatever we call, then these verbs happen really rapidly. She took, she ate, she gave to her husband who was with her. Now he was there the whole time, right? So he was there the whole time. Just FYI, bless you. He was there. All right. So what happened inside of her? Do you find this phenomenal? Here's the external world. There's all the trees out there. There's houses. There's a creek. Here's inside this beautiful home. You may not pay any attention to any of this, yet we see it's lovely. It's aesthetically pleasing. We just enjoy it. Now, what would cause something to jump out in relief and be pulled forward? And we're not noticing anything. We're just walking around. What do you think would cause something to jump out at us and we see it?
Someone making a comment?
Sure. If somebody draws our attention to it, now we see it. So, you know, figuratively, if I ask everybody to close their eyes and, you know, look around the room first and find something black. And look for everything you can find black. Now close your eyes, and I said, tell me anything green. So whatever your brain focuses on, you see it. If somebody calls attention to it, it jumps out in stark relief. Now think of anything inside of us that would cause something to stand out in relief. You could walk by it every day until one day it jumps out at you. What do you think would cause it to jump out at us, at you, from in here? What would change? What would have to be in here for something to jump out? What if you walked by it and you wanted it?
Desire.
What if you wanted it? It was aesthetically pleasing and you wanted to take it home with you. You'd be tempted maybe to put something in your pocket. Why? Don't overthink it. I just told you. Aha! Uh-huh. So once it's fulfilling to the ego for self-enhancement, you notice it. Does that make sense? It didn't appeal to you before then. So something's going on here that inside, when she wants it, desires it for self-enhancement, she sees it. She walked by it every day. But now it jumps out of her and takes front and center stage. We could walk by, we could see people and not notice them until maybe they serve a purpose in us, then we see them. Because they're useful to us. But we didn't notice them before. Now, are you tracking with me? Okay, so something happens inside. External reality remains the same. She walked by, she and Adam walked by this fruit every day. I don't think it looked the same way until after this conversation. Something jumped out. And my point is, something changed inside for external reality to come alive. Now, I gave you two bonus point questions last week, and I didn't really cover the first one. I covered the second one. In what context do we find these verbs in the New Testament? She took, she ate, she gave. You're going to celebrate it this week. Yeah, you find it at the Passover, what becomes communion. On that night, before his crucifixion, Jesus took the bread, gave it, said, "Take, eat, this is my body, broken for you." So these verbs, which introduce sin into the world, now are redemptive verbs. Every time that we celebrate communion, Lord's Supper, we're celebrating what the second Adam did that the first Adam could not do. Make sense? All right, so bonus question number one that I skipped over last week. What was the fruit? What'd she eat? What do you see pictured in all the paintings, etc.? Where'd that come from? Why an apple? Oh, that was good, Julie. Julie quietly said, Adam's apple. Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Very nicely done. So here's your bonus trivia question answer. In Latin Christianity, malum, M long A, L-U-M, means evil. Malum. Uh-huh, malum, right? The word for apple in Latin with a short A is malum. So they said, what fruit was it that introduced evil into the world? Well, it had to be an apple, because the whole apple species in Latin is spelled the same with a different vowel change in pronunciation. So there, that's why you see all the paintings. What fruit did she eat? Why in the world did we come to associate that with the poor apple? I like apples. I mean, are we saying every time I eat a great Honeycrisp apple, I am introducing evil into the world? I hope not. Yeah, so isn't that interesting? All right, so here's the point. What goes on inside of us influences how we perceive and see things outside of us. Have you ever thought about that? How we see something and why we notice it or don't notice it may be because of something operating inside of us. It was there all along. I wonder what changed inside me that I could see it. So you could say, desiring, lusting, and coveting, the moment we want something, somewhat distorts our perception, and we see something now because we want it. Do you remember the flashback in Lord of the Rings trilogy, if you're a Tolkien fan? When it all goes back to how Gollum originally got the ring, do you remember how he got it? Anybody watch or read Tolkien?
He found it.
Yes, he found it. He did. And what was the occasion of when he found it? Yes, good job. He was fishing with his brother. And his brother held the ring. And what did Gollum say to him?
I want
it because it's my birthday. We say that in our house quite often. That's why Sally's giggling. You see that. Was it his birthday? Probably not. Maybe it was near. That's just an excuse. I want it. Here's a self-justification. Because it's my birthday. You give it to me. I want it. And so he coveted it, he took it, and he killed his brother. That's how he got the ring. Okay, so when stuff like this goes on inside of us, the outside world is more distorted. So this is a major lesson in the Old Testament, very beginning in the very book of Genesis, to set us up for the giving of the law in Deuteronomy. When God redeems his people out of Egypt and brings them to himself, he gets more specific about how to be in relationship with him, because now he is their God and they are his people. They're a nation who's been rescued. And God says, now here's what the covenant looks like that we're going to make, and I need to spell it out because you don't know how to be in relationship. Don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, and don't do this. You do this. You love me. Okay? So he's bringing them out. He is their God. And he's saying, be very careful once you start to lust and covet for things that are not yours. A lot's going to go on inside of you. Things are going to get distorted. Don't even worship the stars, the moon. You're going to be tempted to because they're so beautiful. Let's don't do this. You're my people. Let's maintain clarity. I am the Lord your God. Now the idea here is, I want you to think relationally with me. Stay with me, because I know I can get abstract. The more we emotionally invest in something we perceive we want, the less objectivity about that we have. We cannot perceive it for what it is. We see it for what we wish and desire and want it to be to fulfill us. So back in Genesis, this is a beginning story that God is telling to say all idolatry begins in the heart and the mind. Nothing tempts unless we give it power. It all originates inside our hula hoop. If it's aesthetically beautiful, it tempted us to attribute qualities to it to fulfill us. Just because something's aesthetically beautiful, enjoy it for what it is. But don't make it into something that it's not by saying it's going to fulfill all of me inside me. Or our perspective then gets blinded and distorted. Now, can you give me any example? Don't think relationally. We're going to get there. Can you just give me any example of something that the more you emotionally invested in it, the less you could see it for what it was? Others could see it, but you could not. Oh my gosh! For those, okay. Brilliant. Brilliant. Okay. To my wonderful question, the answer came, the Texas Rangers. Now we have globalized the concept to any sports team in Dallas. We could move to the Dallas Cowboys, right? And then to the Mavericks, to the Stars. Did you ever come to a place in your life that you realized the more emotionally you get ramped up by watching the Cowboys and really getting excited emotionally during the game, watching it on your TV, did you realize all of your emotions are not going to affect the outcome of that game? Wait, is that a spoiler alert? Did I just really bust somebody's bubble right there? Don't you love the fans who are just screaming and yelling if you're attending a game and you've got one or two yelling at the top of their lungs in 70 to 80,000 people at some players on the field who can't hear them?
What about if you yell at the TV?
I've never done that. Liar! Isn't this funny? All of our emotional reactions are not going to change anything out here, per se. All right, Rangers, can you give me anything that you were going to purchase?
Buying a home.
Yes. Yes, buying a home. So you get all emotionally invested in it and you really don't pay much attention to the inspection report and the foundation problems. Why? Because you want it. It's your birthday. Just saying. Think of any other examples. The more you personally invest, the less clarity you have.
Our pets.
Pets. Ooh. I already went there. I almost really got drawn and quartered and hung in effigy when I talked about pets and emotions last week. So we invest and we might not be able to see them clearly, and maybe our friends are going, oh my Lord, why are you spending so much money on your pet? I'm sorry, I still missed it. Yes, on an unruly dog. Can you give me now in the area of relationships. How does this might play out?
You're blinded, your friends are all going, oh my gosh.
That's right. That's right. Maybe we invest in a relationship and yet outsiders, our friends, are going, whatever, this is not going to turn out well. But we have an emotional investment. Because of that emotional investment, which is an internal kind of thing, it blinds us to the reality of the external. But other people who don't have an emotional investment might say, yes, yes. What were you thinking? And I don't know what he or she sees in him or her. At this point, why is Cupid portrayed as blind? Right? He's a winged creature. Do you know why he's winged?
Escape fast.
Escape fast? That was great. So Cupid can escape fast. Now, he's winged because the Romans and the Greeks felt like love is capricious and it flits from to and fro and hits you and leaves you. It's very ephemeral. It comes and goes. Okay? All right. The greater the investment, the less objectivity. No? Just a couple of scriptures. Perhaps you've never associated these. Let's make a link. Psalm 135. The idols of the nations are but silver and gold, the work of a man's hands. They have mouths, they cannot speak. They have eyes, but they do not see. They have ears, but they do not hear. Nor is there any breath at all in their mouths. Those who make them will be like them. Yes, everyone who trusts in them. Now, the psalmist is describing what happens to us as the result of powerful emotional investments. So it's both a description and an indictment. What do you think the phrase, after giving this description of inanimate objects, the psalmist says, those who make them will be like them. What does it mean? How would we be like a block of wood? Or a gold or silver inanimate figurine?
Dumb and blind.
Wade? You know, Wade lays out for a long time, and then when he speaks, he just nails it. Dumb and blind. That was succinct and to the point. Yes.
I've been there a lot.
Spoken humbly. Humbly. We each and all have. You are not alone, dear friend. So somehow we become like blocks of wood, blockhead. Because the more we invest, the dumber and blinder we become. And that's how we become like them. I like these scriptures because you're going to see them in Romans and Ephesians. They followed vanity and became vain. Now, I like these two verses here in the Old Testament, because in Hebrew they get very creative with words for idols, and they followed idols and became the property of idols, is the first verse, because one of the words for idols is breath, wind, a puff, wind. It's worthless. You can't grab onto it. It has no solidness. So they followed puffs of wind, and they became puffs of wind. They followed futility and vanity, because they're overly emotionally invested, and the chance of this coming to a fruition is slipping through their fingers. And rather than walk away, what are they doing? Investing more or less? Yes. So this occurs in my office every day. Rather than seeing the relationship for exactly what it is and the futility of the behaviors that are happening, human beings invest more behaviors of the same behaviors that were not working. They invest more. They up the ante and become puffs of wind. They have no solidness because at this point they're each making each other their security mechanism, their teddy bear, and rather than let go, stand on their own two feet, trust God, they redouble their efforts and go all in and push their poker chips all in. Now they're getting even weaker. Please.
Is that doing the same thing every time and expecting different?
Yes, you nailed it. They're grabbing on to futile behaviors. Thank you. Redoubling their efforts because it's all they have, and yet expecting magical results in the universe. We call that magical thinking. Truly magical thinking. Now notice, they followed vanity, became vain. Now this doesn't refer to pride. It refers to lack of substance. They followed worthless idols, the next verse in Jeremiah, and they became worthless. This is the same Hebrew word for idols. It's just a puff of wind. You thought a puff of wind was going to save you? Now notice in Romans 1:18-32, Paul talks about futility of thinking as a result of refusing to worship God humbly on bended knee, humbly. A God who loves us and cares about us, to find our center, their thinking became futile. And then Paul, drawing upon all these idolatrous passages, carries the same theme in Ephesians 4. He says, you didn't learn, you learned to walk in Christ differently, not as the Gentiles, who in the futility of their mind, they have darkened understanding. So in extreme codependency, in extreme emotional fusion, where one person makes the other person their security, their idol, their anchor, their stabilizing mechanism, it really results in futility. Yet they're counting on magical thinking that tomorrow's going to be different when they keep going all in, all in, all in. One day they'll have to stand up and walk away, and then they'll be plunged into darkness because they've weakened. Their whole solid self is weakened now through years of following this path, and now they complain, I'm in darkness and I'm going to die. But you avoided it to begin with. You were getting weaker, but you would never say it is useless. Walk away. Stand up. Trust God. Be plunged into temporary darkness. Come out on the light. Then your thinking and your perspective will all grow clear. You'll look back and go, I was in that pretty deep. Yes. I couldn't see it. You can see it now, though. Yes, I'm ever so grateful. So let's just take, before our break, an example of falling in love. Ooh. So what happens when we... I'm not against this experience, so don't think that I'm just about to trash it to kingdom come. I do want to hold it lightly. So what happens when two people feel a powerful attraction? What's going on inside of them? Do you remember back to the reflected sense of self and a mirror that somebody I deem beautiful or successful or attractive, remember Eve saw that the fruit was now delightful to the eyes? Don't we deem somebody who is awesome, incredible, successful, attractive, wouldn't we want them to like us? Could you tell me why? Would you grab me those two mirrors? See them? Two mirrors. Should be right there. Yeah. Why do we want somebody to like us?
Validation.
Yes. Validation of what?
Self.
Yes. Now, if they're awesome, incredible, successful, I don't know, whatever things you want. It doesn't even have to be cultural people. Whatever the term attractive means, they have some quality that we find desirable. Fair enough? Okay? So let's say, then, Debbie, you take this one because it's got the flower on it.
Okay.
You can stay seated. It's okay. Now, Debbie has that mirror. Now I have this mirror. Okay? Stay within my hula hoop right here. So let's say attraction begins to occur. Let's say I deem Debbie awesome, wonderful, incredible, smart, intelligent, which she is, beautiful and attractive. What the heck are you?
Bill. No.
You want me to come in that direction?
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't say that.
Okay.
No.
And so, remember, with a reflected sense of self, if I deem her with all these qualities, and she happens to share deeming me with these qualities, so when I look at Debbie and she goes, "Hi, Billy." And I think she's just awesome, incredible, talented, gifted, wonderful, attractive. She's pinging back through this mirror a reflection of myself. Make sense? Just as you said, it's very affirming to be liked with people that we deem successful, talented, gifted, awesome, smart, intelligent, killing it out there. You like me? Moi? Moi? And so I ping back, "Hey, Debbie. What's going on?" Now, that's like water to her dry and thirsty soul, and her reflected sense of self has been dead for a long time, and it just came alive. So I am now pinging back to her. We're both looking at these mirrors to see somewhat of a reflection of ourself. Still with us? Still with me? So we're affirming and validating each other's reflected sense of self. Doesn't that feel good? That feels great, doesn't it? Love it. Keep it coming. Okay, thank you. Now, doesn't you like hers? It has a flower on it. I think that's really... All right, so let me put this right here. Watch it crash and break. That'd be real excited. So, let's say each person then becomes idealistically distorted in the presence of each other. Now, what does that mean? They're distorted in an ideal way in the presence of each other. Is that positive? Are they distorted towards a positive thing or negative things about each other?
Positive.
Very positive. So what does the term rose-colored glasses mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you're seeing, if you put on rose-colored glasses, then everything looks... Oh, that was good. I set you up for that. Rosy. Remember the country song? But these rose-colored glasses see only the good. John Conway, I believe. Say it again. Yeah, oh, okay. Oh, okay. Yeah, got that. So they begin to see each other slanted towards a positive. Are they noticing each other's negatives? Why wouldn't they?
Because it feels too good to want to see it.
It feels too good to keep the good coming. They don't want to be interrupted to see more objectively. Still with me? Each then selectively use one part of that person, one good part. They're so fun to talk to. They're so affirming. I just enjoy being in their presence. They listen so well. They use one part to begin to define the whole. So they ignore any negative data and selectively create a narrative where they draw the one, two, or three attractive parts. So the one, two, or three attractive parts now are forming the set of glasses to lead the way. What's happened to the negatives? Suppressed or brought to the surface? Suppressed, pushed back. Each selectively present only the good parts of themselves to each other. Why? That's right. They want the boat to float, so they're not going to bring any negatives to the relationship. They don't want to interrupt the stream to the ego, that's just a word, to the self, of all the good that's coming. Let's don't interrupt it. So I'm nice in your presence and will present my best self. You're nice, will present your best, best, best self. So are the marketing departments working overtime or have they gone home for the evening? I think the marketing campaign is on to be the most ideal, attractive, wonderful human being in the presence of each other. So then each experience more oneness in the presence of each other than they do separateness. I like this. Love is that short period of time. I can't even get it out. People are laughing so hard. Love is that short period of time when our significant other holds the same opinion of us as we do ourselves. All right, now.
It's the beginning of emotional dishonesty.
Well said. It is the beginning of some emotional dishonesty. But both people are colluding in this process. All right, so my grandparents immigrated from southern Poland. So my mama jest Polka. So my mom is Polish. All my relatives on that side of the family are Brzezinskis. So I've been in southern Poland for probably 6-7 months, south of Krakow. Don't you love the Polish name? Can you pronounce her last name? It's Magdalena Samosvanyecz. There's so many consonants in there. Isn't it a great language? Samosvanyecz. So, She's a great writer. Love is that short period of time when our significant other holds the same opinion of us as we do ourselves. So we have two reflective sense of selves affirming each other. You get it? Sooner or later, however, each person's boundaries snap back into place. They are now two distinct individuals again, and the illusion of the oneness is disrupted. Ouch. As time passes, the attraction glue which began the relationship cannot sustain the relationship. It was temporary. It was real. So people say, what? Those emotions weren't real? No, the emotions are real, but the foundation for the emotions is what we're questioning, not the emotions themselves. Over time, each partner gains a more complete and full knowledge of the other. That is, what kind of knowledge? Real life knowledge versus the projected knowledge of getting all the affirmation from myself pinged back from the other person's mirror and them from my mirror. So, almost done. Hang tight. Each partner then comes in contact with the gap between their own projective image of who they projected this person to be, their fantasy partner that will make them complete, and the true image of who their partner really is. Now there's a gap. When that gap happens, most human beings experience disappointment. I would say this is God's design to grow people up, to learn to love. It's going to happen. This is why I said a necessary loss now leads to maturity, because you can no longer get your reflected sense of self from that person. You were never designed to anyway. Make sense? So now it's time to grow up, and now the real work of loving somebody who's completely different than we ourselves begins. Now the work of love begins, to love our neighbor as ourselves. Because they're truly our neighbor. They're not the completion of my reflected sense of self. Right? This is when we say, I will forever cherish my original misconceptions of you. Remember that 5x7 that I have, where I projected all of my reflected sense of self onto you? You see, this is where we understand, I don't think I necessarily loved you, but I sure did love how you made me feel about me. Keep it coming. Don't interrupt it by being you. How dare you be you? You get it? Yeah. Denis de Rougemont, Love in the Western World. But unhappiness comes in between them because the love which dominates them is not a love of each other for the other as that other really is. They love one another, but each loves the other from the standpoint of themselves, not from the other's standpoint. So their unhappiness originates, hang on, in a false reciprocity. Remember, two ticks on a dog and no dog? A false, I love you, you love me, I'll pump you up, you pump me up, I'll pump your reflected sense of self up, you pump my reflected sense. There's a false reciprocity which disguises a what? A twin narcissism. So much is this so that at times there pierces through their excessive passion a kind of hatred of the beloved. That's every emotionally fused relationship right there. It's love-hate. Because all of myself is now attached to you, but the real you is showing up and I'm not liking it. Get back into my fantasy picture. Got it? So sooner or later, the real work of love shows up. Let's take a break. Enjoy this beautiful home. And we'll come back in about 15 minutes.